Good afternoon and welcome to the LaRouche Show. It's Saturday, February 12, 2011, and for those of you who don't buy into this phony President's Day nonsense, today is Abraham Lincoln's birthday. I'm Harley Schlanger, and I will be your host on today's program where we're going to take up one of the most important questions that's facing the American people right now, which is how we can elevate our capacity to think so we can take advantage of the incredible strategic situation which has opened up in front of us, largely due to the longtime work of Lyndon LaRouche, Helga Zepp LaRouche, and their associates. Events of this last week demonstrated clearly why only fools are pessimists. We're seeing at present the next phase in the unfolding of the mass strike process, one which could mean the end of the British Empire with its anti-human imperial monetarist order. From Egypt to Ireland, the revolt against the collapsing financial empire of the InterAlpha Group and the International Monetary Fund grew in both size and intensity. On the financial side, the bankers faced the danger of the blowout of the banks, with the possibility of defaults, as in the case of Spain or Greece, or political action against them, as in Ireland. And those potentials are growing every day. Also, we're seeing cracks appear in their ranks, as we saw in the last days, as two key figures in Germany, Jürgen Stark, who's an economist for the European Central Bank, and Axel Weber, who is a member of the board of the European Central Bank, both expressed in their own ways their displeasure with the hyperinflationary course of Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and European Central Bank Director Jean-Claude Trichet. And here in the United States, the mobilization led by LaRouche PAC and the six LaRouche Democratic congressional candidates to use the truths that were effectively reported by the Angelides Commission, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, to use those truths to get Glass-Steagall banking principles introduced, gain steam, as even some Republicans and one-time Obama-supporting Democrats have begun to rethink their embrace of the British free market policies. And we're seeing state legislators nationwide respond to the idea of producing our way out of the collapse rather than imposing fascist, murderous budget cuts. And we have on LPAC TV a video, a 30-minute video by Anna Shaven, which goes through precisely the accuracy of the Angelides report and gives you a sense of the history of that 20 to 30-year period, as well as delineating how Lyndon LaRouche and his forecasting were absolutely on the mark every step of the way. Now, given that we're in a mass strike period, I have to say it's not enough to have demonstrations in the street or widespread expressions of contempt for the present course or the present leaders. You have many Americans who think that it's enough to vote and then sit around and wait for a change, or to stand around the coffee pot at work and complain. But the question is, how do we move this so we go beyond the present policies into a substantial and fundamental transformation? As Helga Zepp LaRouche reported in a brilliant piece that was written today, which will be up on the LaRouche PAC website, 2011 may be another 1989, when the mass strike ended up with the reunification of Germany and ultimately the collapse of the Soviet Union. The question is, what will ensure that today that we don't allow the British still another opportunity to misdirect the populations through assassination, through terror, through Jacobin-style rioting, which would be used as an excuse for a dictatorship? On today's program, I will have two members of LaRouche's basement team who will tell us what we can learn from single-cell bacteria or bumblebees about the nature of the universe and man, which can guide us today to enable us to use this opportunity to end forever the power of the oligarchy on our planet. So I'm very happy to welcome to the program today Creighton Cody Jones and Megan Roulard. Cody and Megan, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Hello.
Hi. Thanks, Harley.
Now, Cody, let me start with you, because the two of you just came from a meeting, or Megan, you may have something to say also. You just came from a meeting with Mr. LaRouche. I'm wondering if there's anything you would like to add in way of an introduction before we get into the meat of the material.
Well, we can just, one thing is that what Lynn really pointed out was that this past week we went through a fundamental change in this war against the British oligarchy, that we won a decisive battle in the sense that there's now a widening recognition that what you have with this Angelides report is an accurate representation of the organizing that Lyndon LaRouche has been engaged in for 30-plus years. That's becoming ever more clear that the dynamic which produced this report is wholly a function of the interventions and discussions that have been led by LaRouche over this more recent period of the last couple years since the bailout took over. And so that's one point he wanted to make, is that we've won a decisive battle with the Angelides report, and that it was a battle that didn't come out of a simple kinematic effect, which is something I think we'll get more into, but it represented a fundamental change in the system, which brought about this singular effect with the Angelides report and now the reverberations that that's causing throughout political layers around the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that was something he really wanted to hone in on. And getting back to the same point you made initially, this is why we can't afford to have pessimism. That because we have demonstrated an ability to win battles, which means we do have the potential to win the war, but things like pessimism are going to get in the way and kill it if we allow it.
Well, as I've been paraphrasing some of the work that you have been doing in the basement, I think what we've discovered is that the universe is inherently optimistic. And when we allow our own emotional reactions, whether it's fear, cowardice, indecisiveness, whatever, to cloud our judgment, we're actually at odds with the universe.
Right.
Well,
yeah, Go ahead. I was going to say, this is something, yes, that we've been demonstrating, is that the universe is inherently good, that its natural tendency is to change towards the good, in the sense that it's always moving towards becoming more creative, more developed, more energetic. That you go through these successive phases of certain extinction cycles, you know, like we've seen with the extinction of the dinosaurs, which is one that many people are familiar with. But then what came out of the extinction cycle was then a move towards higher levels of development of life, towards mammals, towards the development of fruit-bearing plants, towards creating the kind of platform in life that then made the eventual occurrence of man possible, you know, where we become very dependent on the kind of plant life that emerged out of that period, the fruit-bearing plants. We became very dependent on mammals and then our ability to herd them and use them for food sources and other, you know, plowing, this kind of stuff. That is the natural direction of the universe. It's always moving towards higher states of development, complexity, and creativity. And to the extent that we allow ourselves now to become pessimistic and think that, well, the future only has bad things to hold, or that the natural tendency of man and society is towards destruction and towards evil, then we're embracing an ideology which actually flies against the natural current which governs the way that our planet and really the universe as a whole is organized.
Well, with what you've just said, you sort of preempted my first question for you, but I'm going to go ahead anyway because I think people should know that you have a video up on LaRouche Pack from an interview you recently did with Michelle Fuchs, which listeners can find under The Science of Glass-Steagall. And it is a fascinating presentation about how the biosphere developed, and you just gave us a very, very brief summary. But I'd like you to just talk about why this is important. What you were looking at was the way in which the single-cell bacterias in the ocean created the capability for the production of oxygen, and from that, the development of photosynthesis, the biosphere, which we know today on Earth, including the ozone layer, which protects us. This is quite a fascinating process, and you know, this is, well, again, I would urge people to see the interview, but what can you tell us, that, and just in way of summary beyond what you just said, about the importance of this for the deliberations we have on how we're going to save our planet from the British monetarist system?
Well, there's two aspects that Lena's really focusing on as to why this kind of a discussion is so important. Number one, it demonstrates that even before man emerged as a discrete phenomenon on the planet, that already the natural direction of processes on the planet was anti-entropic, meaning that they're becoming more and more developed, that things were moving from a lower state of existence as measured in terms of, say, energy density, as measured in terms of, say, complexity of creatures, moving from those lower states towards higher states, and that is the natural direction of processes on the planet, that, in fact, the characteristic is one which you would only attribute to a creative process, something which seems to have a willful directionality to it, something we recognize in the way human volition works, but which is something which many people have ignored as the governing characteristic of life as a whole. Now, that life as a whole moves in a direction, even though maybe no individual species is willfully creating the next step, the overall process which bounds life is moving it towards ever increasingly dense systems of organization, energy throughput, etc.
And this is the characteristic of the evolution of the universe as a whole.
Right, exactly. Which totally flies in the face of reductionist ideology, of oligarchical ideology, which would have you believe that, well, actually the natural tendency is towards homogeneity, that we live in a world dominated by entropy, dominated by the second law of thermodynamics, where really what's happening is that the universe as a whole is becoming, you know, it's running out of energy, it's slowing down, it's getting cold, and in the end, the universe is going to be just one dispersed, homogeneous, cold, dead, flat place.
Sounds like Obama.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's like Obama's sex life. But the reality is that the universe, as we demonstrate here on Earth, is always moving in an anti-entropic direction, towards more complexity, towards more new singularities, new generative processes. And so one, demonstrating this throws out the whole second law of thermodynamics and demonstrates it as an oligarchical fraud, really a fraud pushed by the oligarchy to justify their political policies,
mm-hmm.
where you can say, well, since the universe is governed by entropy, by limited resources, et cetera, well, then that justifies why you would have population reduction, why you would have control of resources put in the hands of the elite and, you know, everything we see from a free trade ideology. So we blow that out of the water.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is it also demonstrates that kinematics is not the process by which things unfold, that it wasn't just a kinematic process of one thing bumps into another, which led to something like the formation of the ozone or the oxygen environment, but it was a shift in the whole dynamic of the planet, which had a cascade of different effects. It meant you had an ozone layer, you had an oxygen environment, you had the potential for now moving from single-cell to multicellular organisms, you had the ability of animals to move out of the oceans onto land. So you had a number of different effects, all of which were a function of a shift in the overall dynamic as a whole. And this is something that today in the discussion Lynn brought out as to this is demonstrative of what's actually going on in something like a political process, that revolutions and things don't occur because one guy tweets another guy and he tweets his buddy and somehow you get this Twitter revolution, but that revolutions of the type we're seeing now in Egypt or what we're seeing with the mass strike in the United States are because there's an overall shift in the dynamic as a whole. The whole process is shifting at the boundary layer, and that then has a certain propagating effect through the system as a whole.
You're listening to Cody Jones, one of the members of LaRouche's basement team. And if you go to LaRouchePack.com and go down to where it says basement, and you have to go down a little bit as though you're going down the stairs, but you'll find a fascinating series of articles on the extended sensorium. And now we're going to bring in one of the people who's been working on that team and doing really interesting research, Megan Roulard. One of Megan's pieces was the one that caught my attention today because I hadn't been aware until I read this of the unique qualities that allow bees to dance based on apparently some ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field. So, Megan, what did you find out about this, and why is this significant for people when they're thinking about what we have to do to get our country back to work?
Well, I think it's important to give context for that specific report, which did mention the ability of bees to navigate using the Earth's magnetic field, but also specifically polarized light patterns from the sun in the sky.
Right.
But just in terms of relating this to what Cody brought up, this report on the extended sensorium, and I was able to look at it this way because I wrote an article looking at cases of animal perception and the case of Helen Keller, becomes a very interesting way, in this case through the question of the sensorium, to really get at the distinction between animals and human beings. And Cody brought it up in a specific way, of course, in the question of evolution, where you have a creative principle which manifests itself in a very specific way in the biosphere in a different way, in a characteristically different way with human beings. So this report, really, if you reflect on everything in there, allows you to reflect on a similar question, which was LaRouche's intention with producing this report on the extended sensorium. So what we ended up looking at was, on the one hand, something very useful for people to consider is the fact that the sensorium is not limited to the five senses, which is actually an idea that Aristotle introduced. But in fact, what we elaborate in this report, the panoply of senses or instruments that you're dealing with is really much broader than that and extends into this domain of radiations, which human beings don't, outside of the visible light range, for example. Cody produced a report which looked at the UV perception of cells, polarization of visible light and other light. So this becomes much broader, and it's useful politically in a certain way because it's always important to get people thinking from the standpoint of what is influencing them, which they are not conscious of in terms of their people's everyday activity. What is determining how you think about, or in this case, how you perceive the world outside of you, which, as Sky Shields has said, there's a lot of political capital in that because it's always putting people in that state of mind is always very useful. But then what we found in the reports is, so on the one hand you have this extended sensorium, which senses which you'd say maybe fall under the category of cosmic radiation, not simply visible light, but it also wasn't just limited to that. What you begin to find is that on the one hand, animals which have what you might call super senses relative to human beings. One thing I looked at was the fact that you have animals which have a very honed ability to perceive and act in response to polarized light. It's very weak in human beings.
Mm-hmm.
What you begin to get a sense of, though, is really, I look at the case of this creature called a mantis shrimp.
Right.
Without its eyes, which are its primary instrument, and this is a really fierce little creature, without that instrument, this creature would not be nearly as fierce as it appears. Its ability to interact with the environment, to survive, to eat, to catch other things, is completely dependent on the functioning of this instrument. Now, when you compare that to the case of Helen Keller, which was also something I wrote about,
mm-hmm.
in this report, you get a completely different sense, where here you have someone whose sensorium was, impaired in a certain way. She was blind and deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And there are interesting questions which come up as far as, whether blindness and deafness, as we know it, really means losing everything associated with that particular function of vision or hearing. But what you got a sense very powerfully in her case is that, And this is a point which, Mr. LaRouche makes frequently, and it's really, central to how he thinks about everything. I think now we know it's in light of this Angeles report, it's really important to understand how he thinks. that human beings are really completely different. In the case of Helen Keller, there is actually something, there is actually real substance there, the substance of the mind, which Helen Keller, you know, writes a lot about, and you get a very powerful sense of this from her, which is able to transcend this question of the instrumentation that it has access to. It's able to, you know, fill in for things, and, you know, our ability to act and interact and change our environment is not wholly dependent on the senses in the same way as it is for animals.
Well, you know, I think this is actually a very interesting point, because, as you point out, animals have much more, you might say, developed senses, especially smell, we know from dogs and other animals, and yet the human mind, which lacks that kind of powerful senses, nevertheless is the only being which actually can use the higher senses to be able to figure out what is life and use those principles to organize society. So I think that's actually a very important point that comes out strongly in both of your articles, including especially the one that on Helen Keller, which you titled Mind Over Instrumentation.
Right.
And what did you discover from looking at Helen Keller?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, aside from I already mentioned, one thing that, you know, she refers to just in terms of an example for people to think about is, you know, people, she talks about, you know, she's obviously, you know, she's blind, and she talks about the fact that, you know, the way that she has to construct an image of her surroundings is oftentimes through touch. It's something that unfolds over time. It's not an impression that she receives all at once. Unlike what you get, you know, in the room I'm looking at right now, I'm sort of getting everything all at once. Versus if you can imagine the idea of having to build up that image over time through a sense of touch. And, you know, something which she definitely implies, and I think it's not everything, but it's useful, is it's very important for people to be aware of the fact that your mind is always engaged in creating. You know, you don't simply have, you know, you don't simply have instruments which receive a picture of reality and you're just a receptacle. You're always involved in the creation of that image of your environment. You know, and she does sort of beg the question of whether you can be more aware of that if you lack the sense of vision. So on one level, that's still, and I wouldn't say that's yet creativity, but she clearly was more conscious of the fact that she was playing an active role rather than a simply passive role in creating this sort of, yeah, I would say sort of picture of the environment that she was in. And I think that is, I think in a certain way that might have made her more susceptible then to thinking in terms of real creativity, in terms of, you know, in terms of artistry, or she also clearly had a, she really did have a sense of, you know, what we would call physical economy. You know, she has this quote in one of her writings that, you know, the purpose of man, or, you know, the work of man is to bring mind and soul to the control of matter. So I think the fact that she might have been more conscious of the role that she was actively playing in creating her perceptions, you know, made her more susceptible to thinking in terms of the question of real creativity, which is, you know, not just creating an image of the environment you're in, but really thinking about, you know, how do you create lawful changes in that.
Well, you have another quote
from
her. I'm sorry, but you have another quote from her in which this is really clear, especially on another theme that Mr. LaRouche discusses all the time, which is the classical culture and the relationship of that to the kinds of hypotheses that are necessary for science. I'd like you to just comment on this. She says, in their highest creative moments, the great poet, the great musician, cease to use the crude instruments of sight and hearing. They break away from their sense moorings, rise on strong, compelling wings of spirit far above our misty hills and darkened valleys into the region of light, music, intellect.
Well, I sure can't upstage her with any of my comments on that, but I just say, I mean, when you think about the question of, of musical composition and people who have written about this, like Mozart, actually, when you counterpose that to how something like that is taught in school, you know, composition is taught in school based on sort of listening and like knowing the rules for how certain chords sound, whether they'll sound good or bad. Whereas, you know, many great composers talk about sort of getting the conception of how a piece that they're going to compose, like, you know, as though in an instant. I mean, it's really, you know, and in that sense, it's not based on those simple rules of, you know, what sounds good, what sounds bad. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just comment with that. Maybe something that transcends
right.
What she's talking about.
Well, I have another question for you in a moment that I'll bring up on Beethoven, who's one of the other interesting questions on this matter of hearing. But, Cody, what I'd like to come back to you on is what was clear in the interview that you gave to Michelle was that as you were talking about things that were seemingly unrelated to the current economic crisis, it was also clear that in your mind, everything that you were saying was absolutely central to the state of mind that's necessary to solve the economic crisis. So
right.
Make that connection for us, because I know this comes up all the time. I get emails from listeners to the LaRouche Show, and they say, well, I thought it was interesting what Sky Shield said, or I thought it was interesting what John Segerson said, but what does this have to do with getting Obama out? And, of course,
right.
We know it has everything to do with it. So make that connection for people.
I think maybe the fundamental one is the idea that Lynn has introduced of the platform. That, for example, what we go through in the video is that there was a process that produced the concentration of iron, which is a resource that people are very much dependent on. It, as we say, it's the backbone of modern society, from the buildings to your cars to railroads. Everything depends on iron ore, steel, the things that come out of it. And that was concentrated through a process, an upshift in the biosphere, because of the use of light energy from the sun on the part of these photosynthetic bacteria, which as a byproduct produce oxygen, which then bound with the iron in the oceans and precipitated down, and you get this concentration of iron ore, which we now are able to mine and use into our economy. Now, that's a limited process. That the period of time in which that concentration was taking place was limited. And so you have a limited concentration of iron in a form which we're able to easily access and use and make economical in our economic process. So what happens is that over time, you're drawing down on that resource. It's becoming less and less concentrated. You're having to go deeper into the earth to get it. You're having to go and get sources which are less dense and concentrated, which means you have to put more energy into refining it and pulling the iron out of the dirt and things. And so it becomes more and more expensive under your current mode of technology and your current mode of production to get the same amount of iron ore, for example. Because, you know, the process that produced it in the biosphere, it moved on, it kept going. But we're sort of saying stuck in one mode of action in our economy. And so, in effect, the universe is moving past where we have developed up to so far. Now, the way you overcome that process is you introduce some new fundamental change into the economy as a whole, such as would occur if we move towards a full-fledged nuclear economy on our way towards a fusion economy, where now all of your technologies, all of your mining techniques, your heating techniques, everything is now transformed because you're introducing a new, higher energy-dense source of heat, of production, of machine tooling. So it's this platform concept where you're moving from a lower order of productivity, a lower order of organization of society in terms of manufacturing, mining, and all those things, transportation, towards a higher one, which is more efficient, more energy dense, and which allows you to, say, access iron, for example, less concentrated amounts of iron, but it actually becomes less expensive because you have more efficient technologies. You can create higher temperatures to extract the iron from a less concentrated form of earth. And That's how an economy progresses. And if you don't do that, then in effect you're going to be left behind, because the process that produced those resources which you're depending on, that process kept moving forward. It moved to new higher platforms. But if we attach ourselves as an economy to one previous platform of the Earth's existence, and ourselves don't keep moving towards new higher platforms, then in effect the universe is going to pass us by, and that's how man would eventually go extinct, as you know we're threatened with now with this economic collapse. And so what we see is a couple of things. One, the universe as a whole, and the biosphere specifically as we look at here, it goes through these successive phases of lower to higher platforms, where the introduction of a specific technology, say a biological technology like photosynthesis, into the biosphere transforms all the relationships internal to the biosphere, where you get the oxygen production, the iron ore production, you get the ozone. All these things have been transformed fundamentally because you introduce a new biological technology into the biosphere. And that it goes through successive steps like that. You know, next thing might be the introduction of skeletal structures and what that meant for the biosphere, or the move towards from cold-blooded to warm-blooded animals, what that meant for the biosphere. And similarly, that's how we have to think about human economics, that we're always moving through the introduction of a new universal principle, not just the technology as such. The technology is the analog of the newly discovered principle, but it's always and only through the introduction of these new principles into the mode of action of man that man is constantly able to overcome whatever existing boundaries are constricting his continued growth and development.
And Cody,
so
you,
just as the biosphere has a platform development concept, so must man in economics. And that's what Lynn's really driving at, saying that's what we have to do now, or else we are going to be faced with a full-on dark age.
And in your discussion with Michelle, I thought it was really quite interesting the way you discussed the way that Riemann identifies this in the habilitation dissertation in terms of this question of the boundary conditions on the basis of principles, but also the fact that you have the microscopic and the macroscopic that we have to deal with, even though we have no instrumentation or direct instrumentation to deal with them, but then how this corresponds to what Vernadsky did. I wonder if you just take a moment to repeat that, because I think that gets at what you were just saying in terms of LaRouche's approach always to the dynamics of physical economy when he comes back to Riemann.
Yeah, this gets at the what we've often discussed as the Dirichlet principle in Riemann's work. That one of the things Riemann was looking at was the way that a change in the overall boundary conditions of a process can transform all the internal dynamics of it. That you have a system which is bound by a certain number of parameters. And so everything within that system is going to operate as a function of those parameters. Now, the only way you change the system is not by tweaking little individual parts in a kinematic way within the system. You actually have to change the boundary conditions through the introduction of a new principle, a new singularity. When you do that, that changes and transforms the entire internal relations of all the processes. And that's Riemann's idea of the Dirichlet principle, of defining a process in terms of its boundary conditions and its singularities. Now, it's precisely that quality of thinking that Vernadsky invokes whenever he develops his notion of these nested phase spaces, the abiotic, the biotic, or the biosphere, and then the noetic, the domain of human cognition, that each one of these is bound by a certain characteristic, such as life as a principle which bounds the entire biosphere. And it's changes, singular changes in that boundary condition of life, which changes the entire internal dynamic of the biosphere as a whole, such as then also what you have with the noosphere. It's the introduction of a new discovered principle, such as Kepler's discovery of universal gravitation or Bach's discovery of the well-tempered system. A change in the quality of thinking into society as a whole then changes all the internal relations of how human beings relate to each other and how human beings are going to relate to nature and the universe from that point on. And the funny thing is that the nature of these discoveries always comes through our investigation of principles and processes which exist outside the domain of sense perception.
Right.
You know, this idea of always going smaller and smaller into the small, that, for example, you know, our discovery of chemical processes, that was an investigation into something very small. We then moved from chemical processes to nuclear processes with nuclear power. Then we can go to the subatomic, which gives us an insight into the way something like fusion operates. So we're always going down smaller and smaller, past any level of our ability to perceive it through our immediate sense perceptions, but which we can only know as fundamental principles of sort of what is the characteristic curvature of the space-time in that domain, mm-hmm. which then, as we discover it, unlocks a whole new power for man to then, in a funny way, expand how far we can go out.
Well, let me take that as a lead into the next question I'd like to give to Megan, because in reading through the paper that you wrote on polarization sensitivity, you have a very provocative ending, which obviously is your investigation into what LaRouche is writing about the sixth sense. You know, he had a very fascinating article on that up on the LaRouche Pack website. And you raise the question, it seems to me, about some more powerful development of the senses, which would be governed by this higher principle of creativity. I wonder if you could say something about that.
I would go back to what LaRouche said, where he first brought up this idea of sixth sense, which he brought it up in a paper which you can find on the LaRouche Pack website. But he brought up the provocative idea that, for example, you have, and he brought up the specific cases of music, which I'll just bring up because for me that's been the clearest way for me to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
That and this also came up in the piece on Helen Keller and a couple other reports, in the extended sensorium report as a whole, is a question of whether in musical composition or the communication of musical performance, whether there is something beyond, for example, simple sound vibrations, as which we tend to just think of music in that in those terms. Whether there's something beyond that, which is actually being communicated. But I think if you look at the case of Helen Keller, for example, and it's very interesting to see some video footage of this when she's interacting with different musicians. There's some really neat video footage where she's, with a string quartet, and she is touching the violin, or an evening where she's spending an evening with a mezzo soprano who's performing an aria, and when you see the real joy that she is encapsulated by, really made me ask myself, and LaRouche refers to this case. I'm bringing it up because when you refer to the idea of the sixth sense,
mm-hmm.
and potentially senses, he said, in the domain of cosmic radiation, things that were, he said, in a certain sense, and I don't really have the answer, maybe more transcendental to the other senses, more generative in a certain way. Whether we can get that kind of idea, incorporate that into our conception of the panoply of the senses, and whether there's something which is maybe more powerful in a different kind of way. But I think when you watch Helen Keller interacting with these musicians, you really ask yourself, what is she so moved by? Is it simply vibrations, or is there some other kind of, is there something else which she's perceiving, which is helping to create this kind of effect?
You know, Aaron Halavy wrote a paper on this, on the question of bringing up, going back to Riemann and the ear, and he makes an interesting point, which you just reminded me of, which is the difference between going to a live concert and listening to even a good recording. What you're getting at is this question of the human quality that's involved. How do you communicate in a human way with another mind?
Right. And I would say, I mean, I would say if you, even if you were able to, you know, isolate maybe something else which was involved in, you know, what exactly is produced and received with the bel canto singing voice, you know, let's say hypothetically, because, you know, what Aaron Poe's was very provocative, and also what Sky Shields, you know, alluded to in his paper,
mm-hmm.
let's say you could isolate something else, which maybe it would be some electromagnetic frequency, maybe it'd be something completely different. You know, it would surely elevate our understanding of something like what you're saying, why maybe, you know, the method for generating MP3s is just, completely... And Aaron does really make the case that it's completely incommensurable.
Mm-hmm.
But I think also I don't think if we figured that out, I think, you know, we still wouldn't be able to explain how great composers produce the music that they do.
But now what we're getting to is the nature of creativity. Because if you're talking about a great composer, there's something that there's what we call a musical idea, but it's something not expressible in words. And I know this because I've tried to teach classes repeatedly on especially what Mozart learned along with Haydn from working through Bach. And, you know, it's somewhat sad to have to say this, but it's easier to understand this from playing it or from hearing a good performance. You can't really discuss it. And it gets back to another point that Cody and I were talking about before the program, of the inadequacies and the difficulties of these kinds of discussions that are inherent in language, and why it is that
right.
LaRouche always emphasizes this question of irony.
Right, and I think in terms of what you're bringing up, and in terms of you know, sort of unifying the whole discussion for people, I mean, the question of creativity is what Cody and I are both discussing, and.
Mm-hmm.
I think where the limits of language comes up in a certain way, you have a creative principle which manifests itself, but it manifests itself in a different way in the development of something like the biosphere, that as opposed to how it occurs in human beings. On the one hand, in human beings, it's willful. You know, on the other hand, human beings can be creative, can you know, completely change the organization of the universe as individuals. Whereas in what Cody's developing, you know, it really occurs more on a, you know, on a species level. You know, you wouldn't say that the, you know, an individual cyanobacteria is creative in and of itself in terms of the effect, you know, the effect it was able to create.
You mean it's not sitting there saying, here comes some ultraviolet radiation, let's grab it?
Yeah. But I think, you know, and in terms of the discussion of Riemann and something else which Mr. LaRouche has alluded to, and, you know, allowing real developments in science to change your mathematics and your language, you know, it is funny having this discussion where we just have the word creativity to use,
mm-hmm.
but it's really characteristically different. You know, it manifests itself very differently in these various phase spaces, but we sort of, you know, use this one word, but we find that we do need to modify it, whether we're talking about the evolution of the biosphere or, you know, a composer.
Well, see, I think that's why in music or great classical poetry is so important, because you actually see in a piece by Mozart or Beethoven, or Lynn recently has talked about Schumann, you actually see a musical irony appear through the use of notes and a succession of notes, but the irony exists above the notes in the mind that created it. And I'd like to throw this out to Cody, because I know he's been working on this and thinking about this for a long time, but we're coming back to this question of a population which is angry, it's frustrated, they want to do something about the bailouts, they want to do something about Obamacare, and yet they're liable to turn on and watch a replay of the Super Bowl for the next 4 hours rather than take up the actual nature of man, which is willful creativity. So how do we take what we're doing now, what you're doing in the basement, and what we're doing on LPAC TV, how do we get it out to a population which in many ways has almost, we've almost lost civilization because of what appears to be either laziness or disorientation to give up the actual nature of man.
I think part of it is to demonstrate to the population that the universe is coherent with the good desires that they have, that all human beings are inherently good, that their natural tendencies are to want to see other human beings succeed, to see cultures develop, to see the world become a better place. They want themselves to actually have a meaning in their life which extends beyond just their simple pleasures and beyond just the time between their birth and death. But when you grow up in a society which has had no progress, which has had nothing but destruction, whether it's through war or it's the takedown of industry, and they're just...
Or Cody, let's look at this younger generation that LaRouche is talking about, which grew up in the Greenspan era. You know, if you're 18 years old today, you grew up thinking Greenspan was God.
Right, right. So though you may have these inclinations towards the good, all you're getting, all that's being fed to you through your senses, really, is nothing but destruction, pessimism. And so you have a conflict. You say, well, for whatever reason, I have an inclination towards, say, an immortal existence, whether they acknowledge it or not, but all I see around me is destruction, and that creates a lot of confusion, a lot of anger. But now by presenting these ideas about the nature of the biosphere or exposing people to beautiful classical art and the kind of ideas that Lynn is developing, you give them a sense that actually the fundamental characteristic of the universe is not what they've been exposed to in their short lifetime, but it's actually longer-wave processes of development, of optimism, of a movement towards more creative potential in the universe. And so by presenting that to people, you start to give them a look behind the curtain, so to speak, to see, well, what's the kind of process which lies behind the phenomenon which I only have access to through my senses. And in that way, they get a certain kind of optimism that, well, doing the good is actually what's universally true. And as Lynn has made the point, this does get at the substance of what morality is, that morality is acting in a way which is coherent with the way that the universe itself is naturally organized and the natural tendencies of the universe. So to be pessimistic is, in a certain sense, is an immoral act. You don't really have the right to be pessimistic in terms of what the universe is demanding of the role of mankind in this universe, to be creative, to be, you know, to play this developmental role on the planet.
So perhaps someone could be inspired even by wishing to be as creative as these single-cell bacteria.
Yeah, that'd be a start.
And Megan, I know you've been organizing. I remember you were up in the working with the Rachel Brown campaign. You know, one of the questions that comes up from our organizers is, how do we bring this material into the day-to-day organizing? Because, you know, the average organizer who gets a little bit under it starts to think, you know, it's hard enough to get someone to stop to talk about how to get, you know, stop losing jobs and homes and getting to think about that, much less think about this question of the extended sensorium. And then when you find someone who might be interested in that, you end up talking for 6 hours, and, you know, at the end the person says thanks for the information and walks away. So what kind of ideas do you have about how organizers can use the material that you're working on, that Cody, Sky, Ouyang, and others are working on, to give people the sense of their own inherent creativity?
Well, I would say, I mean, especially right now, really with the release of this Angelides report and the grid that we have on the website now on the FCIC page and the video now on the website, the FCIC report, mm-hmm. A moral test. I mean, what this video goes through, and it's very useful, is that, you know, on the one hand, it counterposes, what the FCIC report said was occurring and which was wrong at the times that they occurred, like the takedown of Glass-Steagall, for example, is an important one that they focus on. But what we see here is really decade by decade, Mr. LaRouche, I mean, the FCIC report and the commission, it's extremely important chronicling, but it is done in hindsight. Mr. LaRouche was there on the scene,
right,
making these forecasts and calling for what needed to be done as this process was unfolding. And so, and that's documented, you know, now very well in this video and really in other material that we have. So I think, frankly, people right now have a real, it is really in people's self-interest and in the interest of the human species to figure out how LaRouche thinks about everything, about the development of the universe, you know, from the oxygen crisis to, you know, forward, to really look at why he, you know, and really it does come down to this question of sort of getting a handle on the type of creative development which is already there, and then how lawfully human beings can intervene to shape that. I mean, fundamentally, that's it. That's what, you know, that's what he has really studied and mastered. But I think with the release of this report and really showing the failure of every other economist out there, it's really, you know, it's really an incentive for people to figure out how he thinks about everything, frankly.
Well, interestingly, in the case of LaRouche, you have a very clear example of how ideas can create physical change. And I think, you know, Cody, as someone who was out in California with me for years, remembers the Phil Angelides, who was the state treasurer, who was not all that, didn't seem to be much of a powerful thinker or figure. As Lynn said recently, well, what do you expect from the California Democratic Party? But we saw a change. And what was the change? It was the effect of the organizing process that Lyndon LaRouche has initiated with the series of webcasts going back to the, as you say, in the real time, the 2007-2008 period. And, you know, Cody, this does get at this question of people who are yearning for something better can actually look and see that can be created.
Right. And he also, I mean, something that's interesting to get back to how this connects even into some of the work on Beyond the Sensorium, et cetera, is that you've got, in this, you've got a funny counterpoint, because as Megan was saying, you've got the Angelides report, which after the crisis is now looking back on and looking at, well, what actually was the process that led up to the crisis, which they only acknowledge once the thing blows out. And all during that period, probably most of those people, as most average citizens who were, you know, in a fairly stable condition, were looking around saying, hey, everything looks great. Everyone seems to be getting rich. The value of my house is going up. I can get extended line of credit. You know, centrally, everything seemed like it was going great. So from a central standpoint, there was one perception of reality versus Lynn, who's not looking at centrally what's going on around him, but he's looking behind the shadows at what's the process, what's the actual physical dynamics which is operating during this period.
Cody, I think I have a quote from him on that from today. I think Lynn said, the universe we think we live in doesn't exist.
Right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
And so with this report, looking at both the report itself and then counterposing it to what Lynn had been saying and doing during that period, you get a very good counterpoint between a belief in a reality based off of your sense perceptions and a real knowledge according to an understanding of the processes, the physical principle processes which are driving, you know, what you're seeing around you. So in that way, it directly ties into the whole discussion we've been having and reporting on of both the principle of processes and dynamics and also sense perception, you know, the issue of sense perception versus real creativity and real mind.
Right.
Megan, you have something to add?
No, yeah, that's completely right. And, you know, just in terms of yeah, relating it to the report, I mean, Mr. LaRouche, you know, says that he had an insight, you know, the day after Franklin Roosevelt died, of a certain direction that things were going to go in. And, you know, we had looked back a while ago, I mean, yeah, in terms of physical production, all sorts of things, you know, into the 50s, you know, things looked pretty good into the early 50s. But, you know, Mr. LaRouche was also taking things into account, like what was occurring with the culture, that there was, you know, with the Congress of Cultural Freedom, there was there were operations to actually affect how people, you know, how people were thinking, which you know, he was tuned into and which allowed him to have the insight into saying then that, that things were actually going in the wrong direction. So, yeah, I think Cody's completely right.
Well, you know, as one who lived through a lot of that and in a, at least a semi-sentient state, you know, I was there from 1972 with Mr. LaRouche, and during the 80s I did a lot of writing on the economy. And so I look back at the Angelides report, and then I can go back into my files and see where Lynn had made comments, and then I had written articles. For example, John Hofel and I did a whole series of articles on the idiocy that led to the collapse of the savings and loans. And now what we're finding is the people who are opposing the Angelides report were the very same people who put through those policies in the 80s, including this one notorious character, Peter Wallinson, who is the dissenter on the Angelides Commission, one of the four Republicans, who was working in 1981 admitting that at, in the Treasury Department, his job was to repeal Glass-Steagall. And so the question of why people like that are allowed into these commissions today, where essentially he's a hack defending the banks, as one of our organizers put it in Washington, kissing the ass of the Queen and the British banks, these are the people that we're fighting. Now, we just have a couple of minutes left on the program, and I'd like to get a, give you have a chance to give a sense to the listeners of where we're going next with this basement project, because the if you look at the way this has evolved under the cosmic radiation work that Lynn initiated, we've now picked up this question of the sixth sense. Where are we headed now? What are you working on, Cody?
Well, we've got a couple of different things we're doing. One, there is going to be a continued development of the type of pedagogy that was brought up in this discussion that Michelle and I had of looking at these dynamic processes of development in the biosphere to further get at the anti-entropic nature of the universe in the context of cosmic radiation and galactic processes. So we're going to continue to put out videos that, that drive at that idea to further give our audience a sense of what is this idea of an anti-entropic universe, which governs Lynn's thinking about economics, as well as then moving sort of into some of the next phases of what was intended with the Extended Sensorium project. That was never to be a, an open-shut project, but it was part of a progression towards what Lynn has always been driving at, which is getting at the substance of creativity itself. So we're developing some reports. Megan is doing a couple things she can mention on you know, really attacking reductionism on the one hand and showing the fallacy of reductionism, then from the other side, looking at how the only way you can understand paradoxical processes in, say, the biotic and abiotic is by starting from the top down of the way processes operate in the human mind, creativity, as the ordering principle reflected in the lower domains of the biotic and abiotic.
So, Megan, we have about a minute for you. What, where are you headed with this work, then?
I don't want to. I think that's a pretty good summary. I just characterize it as, you know, what Cody said. We have more in the works to give people a sense of, you know, the anti-entropic process, which has been developing before human beings were physically on the planet, and then, you know, as you said, in terms of this something on reductionism, really trying to, you know, also inoculate people against the bad ideas which prevent them from thinking in that way, and you know, getting people to be able to start to conceptualize this question of, you know, the distinction between the three phase spaces, not being able to you know, to reduce everything to, you know, to you know, fundamentally, you know, mathematical or you know, simple chemical kinds of operations.
Well, this is crucial work because I'm sorry to cut you off, but we're just about out of time. But it's crucial work. Because you, what you're working on are the kinds of ideas that Lyndon LaRouche has wanted to develop for the whole time I've known him. And now in this moment of crisis with a mass strike where people need to think better and have a better conception of what it means to be human, this to me is the way we're going to determine whether mankind will survive and get to a new platform based on thermonuclear energy, space travel, NWAPA, and so on, or whether we're going to go into a dark age in which the best we could hope for would be to be reincarnated as a single-cell bacteria. So, Megan and Cody, thanks for joining us today. This has been The LaRouche Show. We'll be back next Saturday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, with another program.
All right. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.